Welcome back, folks. This is Mark Steiner. We're about to have a conversation with a woman who's been on the show many times over the years, Stephanie Kuntz. She's written, the first time we met, it was the book, I think, she wrote, The Way We Never Were, American Families and the Nostalgia Trap. She wrote The Way We Really Are, Coming to Terms with America's Changing Families and the Social Origins of Private Life, A History of American Families. She teaches History and Family Studies at Evergreen State College in Olympia, Washington. Director of Research and Public Education for the Council on Contemporary Families, and the author of Strange Stirring, The Feminine Mystique and the American Women at the Dawn of the 1960s, which we talked about, I think, last time she was here. And she's written this piece in last Sunday's New York Times called Why Gender Equality Stalled. Betty Friedan's book led to profound attitudinal changes, but our system still favors old stereotypes. And Stephanie, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Thank you. It's nice to be back.
Stephanie, one of the things that I loved about the way this article was done, because we have this notion in America that women and people have changed their minds drastically since the 1960s, when there was a sort of a blossoming of the women's movement, and that we've gone back to our old ways. But it's not quite as simple as that.
No, not at all. I mean, I think there's been a tremendous revolution in consciousness, and there's also been a tremendous revolution in laws. And in both, there are still some weaknesses in both. I mean, we can talk at a certain point about some of the ways in which we still have some remnants of the feminine mystique creeping around in our head and in our daily action. But really, anthropologists and historians and sociologists have been looking for some time and thinking, well, maybe things have stalled. Maybe people are just over the feminist movement. And you do get these people saying, well, it's all over now. There's nothing more. And really, it was only all about choice. And if we choose to stay home and raise the kids, that's just our choice. And so there's been a lot of talk among feminists and academics about how the gender revolution has stalled. And I just, the more I thought about that, the more I realized that I don't think that's really the problem. I think it's that we've kind of hit a wall, at least in terms of work-family issues, in terms of how far we can go within the existing structure. We may want equality as much, we may want it more than ever, and we may know that it's good for us and ends up with happier relationships. But, when you're two people trying to hold down three full-time jobs or more than full-time jobs, something has to give. And so I think what happens is that people have backed off from some of the expectations of equality in male-female relations just because we live in a society that, I used to say it was Neanderthal, but the Neanderthals took better care of their dependents than we did. But it's the last in the rich industrial world. And in fact, if you look at the entire world, it's us and about eight little island countries that don't have paid maternity leave.
We're one of them.
Yeah, one big country and then a few little islands. And the rest of the world has paid maternity leave. 81 countries have paternity leave. Most advanced industrial countries have health care so that if you drop down to part-time work, you don't lose your health insurance. Most of them also have much better child care than we have. Ours is totally unregulated and in terrible shape. And, it's kind of sad because in 1971, the Senate passed a comprehensive child care bill, but it was vetoed by Nixon, and we've never even come close to it again. It's like the stall is not in what people want, what men and women on the ground want and in their families want. They've been struggling very hard to get toward equality. Men have changed immensely, so have women. But the stall is in what our government and business leaders are doing, and that is that they have made no accommodations to the real world. They still act as though we live in a world where every worker has a wife at home to take care of life.
One of the things that it's really important, I think, that things I was thinking of that what your article posited, and it, in terms of what you just said, I mean, we have this, the consciousness has grown immensely over the last 40, 50 years in America. I mean, more men, as the study shown that you talked about, believe there should be more equality in the home between men and women in terms of work and everything else. How that plays itself out is a question that we can also debate. But, I mean, the consciousness has shifted. But while the culture has shifted in some ways, the politics and the economics have not shifted.
No, not at all. And in some ways, they've gotten worse. You know, we Americans used to work fewer hours per week than our European and Japanese counterparts. Now we work more hours per week. In 1993, when we passed the Family and Medical Leave Act, which was, a modest start. It was unpaid leave for only 12 weeks, and it had only covered about half of American workers, but it seemed like a start. But since then, we have done nothing, while all of our European counterparts have done these family work reconciliation acts that have made it easier and easier.
Well, one of the things, what you just said, let's explore that for a minute and what effect you think that you posit this has on families. So when you write in the article that 80 years ago, in 1933, the Senate passed, overwhelmingly voted to establish a 30-hour work week. It failed, but then the Fair Labor Standards Act of 38 gave Americans a statutory 40-hour work week. And as you just said, that American workers spent less time on the job than their counterparts in Europe and Japan in the 1960s. But up comes the 1990s and 2000s, and it's turned its head, and our average workload is outstripped them all. And, I mean, that's what's shifted, and I think that's what we're not wrestling with in terms of what women want in terms of their careers and raising families, what men want in the same way, and those are the parts that we never bring out in the conversation.
Well, and there's been this huge polarization, actually, in terms of work hours, that leads people to be time-stressed in totally different ways. At the upper end of the income strata and education strata, professionals, educated people, their work hours have exploded. You know, we used to talk about banker's hours. In the 1950s, banker's hours where you go in at 10 and you get off at 3.
Right, right.
Now bankers work much longer hours than that. And if you want a good job, a challenging job, a job that has a lot of money, you really do need to work these tremendously long work weeks. At the same time, the work for lower educated, less educated, and less skilled has gotten worse. They've had cutbacks in their hours. So some people have too few hours. Some people have too many hours. But ironically, the people with too few hours, given the tremendous increase in wage inequality in America, can seldom make it on just one job. So they end up having two jobs and working split shifts. And so they end up time stressed too, but for very different reasons than the professionals. We have to deal with both of those kinds of problems. And we don't even admit that there is this polarization going on in America, far less come up with any concrete demands and programs to deal with it.
So when the poor working people in America who have to work two and three jobs, so in essence, even though their jobs have been come back, they work more hours.
Yes. Exactly.
But we have no social program underpinning for their children, for longer school days, or for any of the rest.
That's right. That's right. And the big difference in work hours, not so much the weekly work hours, although those are very bad for some professionals, but the annual work hours, because we do not have the right to vacations. We have far less vacations, far less time off to recharge. And that's another very important thing. And, you know, if you work a 50-hour week 1 week, but then you get some downtime, that's one thing. But it's when you do it relentlessly over and over and over again, and you never get that time to recharge. And we have such a work culture that people who would take those vacations are often not allowed to. And the ones at the very top don't feel that they can. They feel that they would be thought of as bad employees. So at both ends of the economic spectrum, Americans are overworked and under-supported in their struggle to balance work and family life.
So how does that, in terms of using the word balance, how does that balance out with our historical view of when the women's movement began, which was when we talked last about this in your book and Betty Friedan? I mean, we're talking about a world that at that point was mostly affecting middle-class white women, because working women and women of color worked all the time. They were workers. But how has that affected what exploded then? I mean, what has it done to the consciousness of America, and how it kind of is intertwined with the realities of economic life? How has it affected how we think about it all?
Well, I mean, I think it's so important for us not to romanticize the days when women stayed home and when there weren't so many work balance issues, because in those days, it was like women had no access to meaningful activities outside the home. And men had no access to really being participants within the home. And, you know, that despite all the stresses we have today, in many ways it's an improvement that women can participate outside the home, and men are taking more responsibility and finding more pleasure being more involved parents and being more involved in the home. But one of the big differences then, of course, was that you could overwork the men because most of the women were not out. And even among black and working class women, there was not as much full-time work as there is today. So you didn't have to worry about it. The employer didn't, because he could just assume somebody else was going to take care of the rest of life. And the consciousness was such that it was just assumed that not only was it wrong for a woman to want a job, that the normal woman wouldn't want a job, and she would actually, there would be something wrong with her if she didn't want to spend all of her time at home. The normal man wouldn't want to be involved at home. I remember reading one sociologist who said, well, a guy can occasionally change the diapers or feed a bottle, but any man who really wants to do more than that might be suspected of having a little too much fat on the inner thigh. You know, that was this horrible contempt for both women and for men who wanted to share. So that part of the change of consciousness has been wonderful, I think. Women and men are just much more conscious of their similarities, and that leads to better relationships between men and women. But the problem is that the consciousness of employers and government has not caught up with the fact that today there is not half the human race staying home to take care of the kids. 70% of American children are raised in households where every adult in the family is at work during the day.
Hmm. That's an amazing statistic.
It is.
That blew my mind when I read it. I had no idea it was that high until I read your piece. I'm wondering how you think what the interplay is between this growth in consciousness that has taken place because of things like the women's movement and all the movements that erupted that kind of changed the way people think about their own lives and what they can accomplish, what young women can accomplish, what they think they need to do, as you statistically show in your article. And the role that the economy, our economic policies play in it. I mean, how does that affect our consciousness, do you think? In other words, whether or not you have a society that ensures health care or ensures some kind of daycare or that people can take paternity or maternity leave.
Well, I think you get a vicious cycle here, you know, that to the extent that government is not willing to provide a certain safety net, a certain support system for people when they're working, they begin to think that they have to get everything themselves. Now, this is not the way we would organize our family life. You know, when people who are big pro-family activists tell me, oh, well, we should just give everybody tax cuts, I said, well, is that what you would do in your family? If you came in with a little extra money, you would hand out pieces of it to every member of the family? No. You'd go out and you'd invest. You'd put it in a savings account for college education, or you'd invest in a better home in a better neighborhood. And, of course, that is really what good government is all about. It's like taking those tax monies and investing it in ways that will improve everybody's standard of living and comfort. But when government doesn't do that, when you've had for the past 30 years this attempt, I think it was Grover Norquist who said, to starve the beast, to prevent government from doing that and to only let government take over the things that can't be profitably managed by private enterprise, then you have a situation where everybody feels like they've got to make it on their own. My grandmother used to contemptuously have this saying about people like that, that you get what you can it, and you sit on the can. And, you know, there's a certain extent to which we've been forced into that kind of behavior. If you can't get health care, if you don't have public parks, well, then you want to save as much money as possible to move to a neighborhood that's not yet completely filled up, and there are places for your kids to play. So then, as you save your money to do that and you refuse to invest in public parks, then, of course, that just is a vicious cycle.
One of the people you quote in the article I find it very interesting is the book by Kathleen Gerson, The Unfinished Revolution, Coming of Age in a New Era of Gender, Work, and Family, where it clearly shows that people want a more equal relationship.
Yes.
When it comes to money and raising children.
Yes.
But when push comes to shove, women are expected to stay home and men go out to work when it gets tough.
Yes, and this, it's interesting. What she found is that when you ask people their ideal, men and women basically agree. 80% of women, 70% of men said, we would like to share the breadwinning and the childcare and the home, you know, really equally. But then she would say to them, well, what happens if you can't do that? Well, the women say, most of the women say, well, I would still prefer to have some economic independence, you know, whether I'm in a committed relationship or not. But the men then tend to say, well, in that case, she'd better take care of the home and I'll focus on the kids. And in fact, that's the way it often works out, in part because the guys usually tend to make a little more money, and in part because women, even though they want independence, still have this sense that they're the default parent. They're the ones who have to step in when things are really tough. But one of the things that we're seeing in the research is that when couples do this, when they backslide into these traditional gender roles after the birth of a child, they're not as happy as they think they're going to be about it. The women tend to feel like, you know, resentful because of their exclusion from activities and status that they used to have. They think, well, why isn't the guy doing more? The guy thinks, I've increased my work week. I'm not getting to stay home and spend time with my kid. Why isn't she more grateful?
Right.
A lot of tension.
Well, you're talking about the study that was done by the two psychologists you talk about, Philip and Carol Cowan.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that because it fits so neatly into what the other piece said, and that we are putting ourselves between a rock and a hard place here in America, because we're a difficult time, I think, politically and economically, getting out of the way of our own cultural myths.
Yeah, and you know, one of the reasons I wrote the article is that I was getting so tired of these debates over the choices that women are making. You know, like you get people saying, well, I've chosen to stay home because that's best for my kids. And you have other people saying, no, you shouldn't choose to do that. That's not right. You know, that's not what we've been fighting for. We really need to share this. This is a mistake. And I thought, you know, these are not people's first choices. And there's a lot of evidence. I cite Pamela Stone, but there's a lot of other research that shows the same thing. When you really ask people carefully, these women who supposedly opted out voluntarily, why did you leave? It turns out it was their last fallback position. First, they tried to get their employer to be more flexible. Then they tried to see if their husband could cut back on their hours some. And when none of those happened, and very often they started to meet hostility in the workplace, then they, quote, chose, unquote, to stay home. So I was getting upset at the number of friends and neighbors I had, even who were arguing about, is this the right choice or the wrong choice? And I was saying that they're really not choices.
Mm-hmm.
They're not unconstrained choices. And that's so sad because, first of all, if you say, well, women should be able to choose to stay home, well, that's nice, but what about men then? That assumes that the man in the house is not going to be able to make that choice and has to support them. And it also, of course, ignores the many, many working women in this country and single parents who don't have that choice at all. But the other part of it is it really the choice that women want to make? Most women, I think, would like to be able to not have to make that choice between work and family life. And women who do are forced into make it still have higher rates of depression than women who work outside the home.
And I think that also feeds into this when you were writing about, again, I was really kind of shocked to read it, that over a 20-year period that the U.S. has gone from sixth in female labor participation among developed countries to 17th.
Yes.
I mean, that's pretty astounding.
Well, again, we've just plateaued while other people have continued to increase, the same way that we've done with our attitudes and with our work-life policies. It's just like we said, okay, we got to this certain point, and then the momentum stopped, and we stopped being able to allow people to move forward.
So what is it you think needs to be done? You pointed out some things I think really interesting that I did on the air the other day here as well before I read your article about, single payer, which, you know, we've been talking about for a long time on this program. But when you look at Medicare and how they're not controlling costs. It's not just about single payer. It's about something larger than single payer.
Well, you know, if I had the answers, I probably wouldn't be on the radio. I'd be out leading some kind of movement. So I don't have the answers. But I do know that we're kind of going in the wrong direction. I mean, I think that you've had a couple of states that have passed subsidized parental leave bills, and now you do have discussion of preschool, and it will remains to be seen whether we'll get back to the support, the overwhelming support for this that there was in the Senate back in 1971, or if this Tea Party people and some of the other people who are just adamantly anti-government and therefore, in my opinion, actually hurting the ability of families to function effectively, if they're going to step in and call this socialist, fascist, whatever their current epithet of the day is.
So just before we end, I have to ask you, we didn't have a chance to talk about your last article.
The one on the end of men?
Yes. So is my time over?
Not with me. I can go forever. But yes, if you I thought you meant is your time with me over?
I understood what you meant.
is your time as a man over? I don't think so either. But there have been a lot of books talking about the end of men and the rise of women and how women are becoming the richer sex.
Right.
And I think that this is a tremendous exaggeration. It is true that for the first time in history, a woman's education counts more than her gender in terms of her income-earning power. Until 1970, a woman college graduate working full-time earned less than the average male high school. And in the 50s, she earned less than the average male high school dropout. So today, if you have more education than a man, you usually earn more than a man. However, within every educational level, men and women with the same education, men on average earn more than women. In occupations, women tend to have the middle to lower sections. Men have moved up higher. And, of course, there are more women in poverty than men, although there are an awful lot of men in poverty, too, and I don't want to forget them. So it's not really the end of men. What we have is a situation where women have been able to increase their representation among the high earners of the population more than they were in the past, but they still hang behind, even at the very top. And like men, they have also suffered from the increasing inequality in this society. For example, men bore 80% of the layoffs at the beginning of the recession because most of those layoffs were in areas that were traditionally male jobs.
Like construction.
But in fact, since 2009, women have only gotten 30% of the new jobs and the jobs that have come back. So we're both in the same boat. We're both being hurt by the economic polarization in the society, the prolonged recession, the lack of government support systems that help us make more sense of our work and family lives, and it's not a win-lose proposition.
Well, I mean, as you write in the piece, is you know that 40% of full-time workers in management may be women, but the median wage for those female managers is 73% of what male managers earn.
Exactly.
I mean, that's the reality.
Exactly. And if you look, you know, there was this big media brouhaha because they found out that in several metropolitan cities, young women in their 20s earn more than young men in their 20s on average. But actually, when you look at that, that's because the cities tend to attract a higher share of highly educated women and a higher share of less educated Hispanic men, and that pulls the averages down. If you look at women with a BA versus men with a BA, women with a high school degree versus men with a high school degree, in each of those educational levels, men still do out-earn women.
I was thinking about this as I was reading the article. I started laughing in my living room reading your piece this week in the New York Times. And my wife, one of my daughters, says, "What are you laughing at so loudly?" I was thinking about you, and I was thinking that Stephanie Kuhn should be actually become the host of her own program and take over the program called Mythbusters.
Well, it would be a program that would have to be on 24 hours a day.
Well, you do that in your books. I think you really, you make us think about what reality is and myth in our world of families and how we think about who we are. And I always deeply appreciate what you write and taking time for our program whenever you do.
Well, thank you. That's a compliment coming from you because you do a lot of myth-busting too.
Thank you, Stephanie Kuntz.
Thank you.
You're listening to The Mark Steiner Show. Public Radio, WEAA, 88.9 FM. The voice of the community. Don't go away. We'll be right back after this very short break.